So today I will speak about the Buddhist tradition, which for me has a close affinity in terms of methods to the Vedantic tradition as far as my background is concerned, my studies and my practice. So for the sake of conciseness, I will just read out, and in the meantime we can also stop me for any clarification and then have a discussion. I believe that some of the basic concepts of Buddhism will be understood, so I will take for granted and we'll move on. The objective of this lecture is to contribute to the understanding of Nagarjuna's two-truth doctrine. We know Satya, Samvritti, or Samvritti Satya, and Paramartha Satya. I will use interchange the word Satya and Sat, which appear in literature, as presented in the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, in chapter 24. My interpretation of the relevant passages take the support in canonic sutras, both of the Theravada and the Mahayana, and in post-Nagarjuna commentarial tradition with emphasis on Chandrakirti and Tsongkhapa, so a certain Tibetan line which is actually more rational and more closer, I would say, to the original Indian tradition rather than the Far Eastern traditions, and Zen, for example. And complementary, another author called Kamala Shila. Again, very important for the development of Tibetan Buddhism. As a methodological principle, I will adopt an insider's perspective, more apologetic rather than juridical, trying to reconstruct Nagarjuna's internal logic as a meaningful and coherent articulation between the two truth doctrines on one hand and his overall philosophy of emptiness. Nagarjuna's conceptual framework is directly related to the so-called Mahasanghikas, which were one of the major sectors in the first, let us say, division post-Buddha of the Buddhist tradition, vis-à-vis the Stavirs, for example, where the issue was perhaps more related to the Vinaya and not so much to the Abhidharma at that time. So I am more concerned within the Mahasanghika, which is a general term, a school called and known as Prajnaptivada, and purportedly committed, it means Nagarjuna, to the refutation of another school, which is a later development, called Sarvastivada school. The Prajnaptivada school is one of the earliest proponents of the Two Truths doctrine. It sustained that all phenomena are conceptual constructions, prajna, having no substantiality on their own. The world, as one's mundane experience of seemingly independent subjects and objects, along with their practical differences, is said to constitute samvritti sat, or the conventional truth, where the metalinguistic realization of their fundamental interdependent nature as conceptual constructions, otherwise known as nirvana, would constitute paramartha sat, the ultimate truth. So this is the framework within which, let us say, the Nagarjuna reflection comes into the picture. Deviating from this general interpretation, the Sarvastivada school postulated a distinction between conceptual constructions that made up one's experience, as mentioned above, and the elementary concepts that presumably constitute the minimum indivisible parts of one's composite object of experience. These pre-empirical concepts, certainly inspired by the Buddhas and the Abhidharmic analytical dissection of human experience into constitutive elements technically called the dharmas, the skandhas are one of the types, were deemed by the Sarvastivada to have a substantive, real, and permanent existence, svabhava. For the Sarvastivada, therefore, the revised two-truth doctrine included prajnapti-satta, on the one hand, and paramartha-satta, as twofold dimension of one's conceptual and linguistic dealing. And both were at a linguistic level. In this sense, paramartha-satya, now recast as dravya-satta, would be tantamount to the discursive positive postulation of everlasting entities. The Sarvastivada school's support of ultimate substantial realities, the so-called elementary dharmas, as the ontological constituents of an otherwise interdependent world, seemed to constitute a clear violation for Nagarjuna of the Buddha's words in three basic senses. The first, it brought the idea of an ultimate truth under the purview of propositional sentences. So they are conceptual ultimates, something prescribed by the Buddha, notably in the Kacchanagota Sutta, where his sentence, "Stay away from both the extremes, exists or does not exist." Second, it suggests that a certain level of objective reality was, so to say, immune to pratityasamutpada and to the principle of impermanence, anitya. And finally, while severing one's reality between conventional and non-conventional dimensions, dravya dimensions, the teleology of nirvana as a means to overcoming suffering would end up in a sort of meditative state focused on the later, means the non-conventional primary elements, the dharmas. That is, as a transcendent state beyond pratityasamutpada and one's phenomenic experience. It means going beyond, let us say, our phenomenal experience and beyond pratityasamutpada. Not surprisingly, among Buddhist circles, the Sarvastivada school drew considerable opposition. It was recurrently accused of being directly influenced by Vedic traditions like Sankhya and Vaisheshika. To Nagarjuna, the Sarvastivada stand would amount to an actual dualism that shattered both the epistemological and praxeological dimensions of the Buddha middle path, which is on the one way to refrain from metaphysical declarations is or is not, and from the praxeological point of view of being either egoistically in the world or abandoning it. Finally, this position of the Sarvastivada circumvented fundamental idea of the whole pervasiveness of pratityasamutpada as the Buddha's essential teaching. In Mahati Padapama Sutta, the great sermon on the simile of the elephant's footprint, this is in the Pali, the Buddha says, I'm sorry if I'm not pronouncing it correctly, he who sees the Dharma sees pratityasamutpada, and he who sees pratityasamutpada sees the Dharma. In other words, nirvana is the realization of pratityasamutpada rather than its evasion. Nagarjuna's critical intervention presents a high degree of radicality. Aiming at purging the Abhidharmic tradition from the dangers of reifying the Buddha's analytical discourse by claiming ontological substantiality and permanence to elementary soteriological concepts, Nagarjuna brings into the picture the fundamental idea of emptiness. So here, I think there is a contextual reason to understand why emptiness as a soteriological concept acquires such a relevance. As a means to clarify what pratityasamutpada ultimately stands for. It's a fact that the idea of emptiness never reaches a technical sense in the Pali canon and the Abhidharmic tradition, being therefore intimately associated with what we call the Mahayana. Still, the spirit of the adjectival sense of the word shunya and its derivative shunyata as a condition of being void of essence, nairatmya, is presented in many of the Pali discourses. And it is the outstanding case of the Sunna Loka Sutta, the Sermon of the Empty Universe, where the Buddha proclaims, empty is the world. It is empty because it is empty of its sense, of everything that belongs to it. Therefore, the contextual emergence of Shunyata in the Buddhist tradition and the paramount role of Nagarjuna's Mula Madhyamaka Karika targets a very specific goal. The main objective is to hold Shunyata as a razor sword meant to eliminate any attempt of Sarvastivada type to entrust any kind of substantiality to the major Abhidharmic elementary concepts, even if they are mere understood as ideational and pre-empirical, perhaps in the Kantian sense of the term. One by one, in a sharp and systematic way, Nagarjuna, in the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, unveils the interdependent nature of each and every Sarvastivada elementary dharma. He shows that, inasmuch as in any other empirical phenomena, the elementary concepts are amenable to further analysis and dependent on further causes and conditions, hetu pratyaya. In chapter 4, entitled The Raising and Disappearance of the Skandhas, as the elementary dharmas, for example, at least one of the lists, Nagarjuna analyzes systematically the interdependent nature of the five basic dharmas or aggregates, the skandhas. The constitutive or constituent character of all concepts as concepts of reciprocity, anyonya prajnapti, imply the ultimate dialectical interdependence between every subject and object, agent and patient, preventing the possibility of any substantialized entity, swabhava. Nagarjuna's radical support to the interdependent and conventional nature of all phenomena and all Abhidharmic dharmas constitutes a reinstatement of the eminent character of reality as Prajnapti Sat, and the consequent rejection of Sarvastivada Dravya Sat. This opens the way for the consolidation and further clarification of the actual nature of the Mahasanghika's original Two Truths doctrine, as the epistemological counterpart of the newly explicative term of emptiness as pedagogical and prophylactic concept. Rather than a dichotomy of reality, as the Sarvastivada would have put it, between the impermanent and the permanent, the pair Samvritti Sat, Paramartha Sat, acquires in Nagarjuna's critical context the character of a dichotomy of meaning that coexists in the same phenomenal reality. In his treatise, The Ocean of Rational Reflection, a commentary on Nagarjuna's Mula Madhyamakakarika, Tsongkhapa puts in this way. The two truths are two epistemic isolates of a single given phenomenon, and they are hierarchically arranged. Samvritti Satya points to the level of meaning that hides, or at least does not reveal, the empty nature of reality, that is, their interdependent originated character. It is marked by a subjective disposition to what we may call metaphysical invention, that is, to erroneous project substantiality in unsubstantiality, essentiality in non-essentiality or conventionality, and permanence in non-permanence. Paramartha Satya, on the other hand, points to the level of meaning that realizes conventionality as such. So it's just a realization of what is reality, conventionality, that is, the all-pervasive character of Pratityasamutpada, or the emptiness of all phenomena. In Prasannapada, Chandrakirti glosses Nagarjuna's relevant passages with the following words. Samvritti Satya is the level of meaning that hides conventionality as such, while Paramartha Satya is the level of meaning that reveals it. Paramartha Satya, or Nirvana, is therefore the clear vision of the true nature of Samvritti. It's Samvritti in its full transparency. I'm quoting here also Chandrakirti. It's precisely for this clarified sense of Nirvana that the Mahayana tradition, following their clusters of specific sutras and the words of Nagarjuna, renamed this Nirvana as Bodhi. So it's a new word, which obviously is a synonymous, but at the same time indicates a kind of more precise and clarified understanding of what Nirvana stands for. As a metalinguistic dimension underscoring every propositional and conceptual expression, emptiness is the silence behind every word or sound. Its postulations makes only sense, and that's an important thing, it means of the concept of emptiness, makes only sense because there is a recurrent existential error which tends to superimpose the substantial onto the unsubstantial, this being the proper meaning of Samvritti. Therefore, in Nagarjuna's understanding, the Buddha's words do not contemplate any instance of denial of the world. As Dungan puts, a modern comment, echoing the teachings of Tsongkhapa, the object of negation of Buddha's teachings is not the world of conventionality as such, but the erroneous substantialization of the phenomenon, or what is the same, the lack of realization of the interdependent origination of all phenomena, and the belief in their independent and autonomous existence endowed with self-nature swabhava. In short, accordingly, the Buddha's teachings are meant to prompt one to sublate one's Samvritti perspectives, both the mundane metaphysics of routine attachments to the objects of the world, but also the sophisticated metaphysics of doctrinal philosophers, because there lies the ultimate cause of suffering. Though Nagarjuna's general contextual intervention in the Mula Madhyamakakarika could be described as an attempt to rehabilitate a rather epistemological perspective to the Two Truths doctrine, the specific subcontext in which the explicit mention of it occurs, the two doctrines, suggests an important additional element that may perhaps have been decisive to the consolidation of what one calls today the Mahayana, the Shunyavada current of Buddhism. In fact, Nagarjuna's appeal to the true truth doctrine appears in a dramatic moment of the Mula Madhyamaka Karika. After having forcefully sustained the emptiness of all phenomena, and more specific of all elementary dharmas, Nagarjuna is asked by the opponent late in chapter 24 out of 27, which is titled The Examinations of the Four Noble Truths, the Teachings of the Buddha, if the all-pervasiveness of emptiness would not completely obliterate the Buddha's teachings, and more specifically the Four Noble Truths, they are being made of words and concepts. In other words, the Buddha's Dharma, the truth of the truths, would itself belong to Samvrtivada, the Sat, rather than to Paramartha Sat. In that case, how could there be at all any possibility of Nirvana? Nagarjuna's answer touches the core of what emptiness and the Mahayana actually means, in my understanding. First, he accuses the opponent of not understanding the intended meaning of Shunyata. In fact, says Nagarjuna, the opponent understands Shunyata in the same spirit of any other propositional statement, taking it as a declaration of non-existence. In other words, the opponent thinks that, different from his own postulation of permanent elementary dharmas that would ensure the relative reality of composite phenomena, our experience, Nagarjuna's postulation of the non-substantiality of all dharmas and phenomena would imply that phenomenal reality was just an illusionary world, of which the Buddha's teachings were also irremediably a part of it. To refute those allegations, Nagarjuna is forced to be more precise about the actual status of the Buddha's teachings. First, he reminds the opponent that throughout the text, or the dialogue, he sustained that reality and its recurrent processes of appearance and disappearance of phenomena could only be admissible if things were devoid of self-nature. In other words, emptiness was a prerequisite for the reality of the world and not otherwise. The opponent's postulation of self-existing entities instead would obstruct the possibility of a world-given experience. Second, and that's the core of his rebuttal, Nagarjuna states that having declared the emptiness of all dharmas, there is no possibility of understanding emptiness and consequently all the Buddha's teachings as ultimate ontological doctrines about reality. This amounts to the emptying of emptiness, by which Nagarjuna seeks to free its conceptual dimensions from any ontological claim. In other words, Nagarjuna's position seems to be clear. Shunyata, as much as the Buddha's fundamental teachings, such as the Pratityasamutpada, are not ontological statements about reality. They are not drishtis. Instead, they function as major instrument to eliminate the drishtis. Sarva drishti prahana. And he says, we affirm that the interdependent origination is what we call emptiness. That is a clarification. Now, this emptiness is also dependent on conversion, is prajnapti. Even emptiness is prajnapti. This is the middle way. We have now reached a climax in Nagarjuna's argumentation. How to classify this extraordinary character of the Buddha's words and teaching, and how do they actually operate so as to effectively lead man to Nirvana or Bodhi? The answer to this question is the word upaya, usually translated as skillful means or skillful pedagogy, as a timely and appropriate form of teaching suiting the specificities of each one's suffering and ignorance. In this case, the Buddha's pedagogy is not to be understood, however, as an introductory discourse for the sake of a later definitive one, which sometimes pedagogy could be understood in this sense. There is no definite discourse about reality. Therefore, all the Buddha's teachings, maybe simpler or complex, are to be considered upayas. In other words, notwithstanding the dissimilarity regarding the ultimate nature of reality and language, upayas as language are unavoidable tools to realize it. It's also important to know that the word upaya is not actually mentioned by Nagarjuna in the Mula Madhyamaka, at least in the technical sense it acquires in the Mahayana tradition. But it is factually present all over these and other Nagarjunian texts. Sometimes the word yukti stands for it as the rational upaya par excellence. It means here in this Shunyatakan text, we are talking about an upaya, which is a rational undertaking. The term appears sometimes in the Pali Canon with that precise meaning, upaya kosala, as an attribute of the Buddha, particularly in Sangiti Sutta. But it's in the Mahayana Sutras, mainly in the Prajnaparamitas and the Sadharma Pundarika Sutra, that it emerges a technical term to designate a paramita, means a virtue or a perfection of a bodhisattva, which is particularly associated with Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. In the Lotus Sutra, for example, he appears as a symbol of the upaya, is the upaya. The second question, the structure and the operationality of an upaya, bring us back to the Mula Madhyamaka. From the stanzas 8 to 10 of chapter 24, when this dramatic question is taking place, Nagarjuna describes the operationality of an upaya by resorting to the two truths doctrine. In stanza 8, reads as follows. I'm just reading it. Dve satye samupashritya buddhanam dharma deshana lokasamvrati satyam cha paramarthataha. A common translation is a kind of average of some of the translations I consulted. It goes as follows. The teachings of the Buddha on the Dharma are based on two truths, the conventional truth, samvrati satya, and the truth based on the ultimate reality, or sometimes just translated as the ultimate truth. If we recollect the exact context of the statement above as a reaction of Nagarjuna to the opponent's perplexity over what he considers to be a contradiction between Shunyata and the Four Noble Truths, it means Shunyata dismisses the validity of the Four Noble Truths, we are bound to agree that Nagarjuna's motivations is basically to explain the nature, the status, and the operationality of the Buddha's words. If he is not able to do so, all his highly sophisticated rhetoric will fall apart. Therefore, the idea that Nagarjuna is here introducing or unveiling the Two Truths doctrine as such is nonsensical. Indeed, the so-called doctrine of the Two Truths is not an invention of the Buddha or Nagarjuna, but instead a pan-Indian doctrine that points out to a plurality of epistemological or ontological levels of reality, wherein the conventional truth is useful to achieve temporary worldly goals, but an obstacle to realize the ultimate truth which frees one from all suffering. On the other hand, the idea that Nagarjuna is here describing the actual content of the two truths in accordance to his own hermeneutical orientation is also to be discarded. In fact, the whole text before, right from the beginning till that dramatic point, is but a clarification of his position in that regard, specifically by refuting the Sarvastivada's idea of Paramartha as elementary dharmas, dravyasat, as we have seen above. Therefore, in this particular passage, Nagarjuna's sole concern is to explain in detail how can a discourse that keeps no representational relation to reality can be conducive to the latter's complete realization. In other words, how can a samvritti-based discourse speak of paramartha if the latter is the spontaneous residue of the elimination of the rarest of the former? Finally, the idea that the stanza above may be interpreted as meaning that there are two levels of the Buddha's discourse, one of a pure samvritti, a lower teaching, and another of a pure paramartha type, a higher teaching, is also to be discarded at once. Though the idea of inferior and superior levels of teaching is certainly relevant, the criteria to distinguish between one category and the other cannot certainly be the two truths doctrine, for the simple reason above discussed, that Nagarjuna's demolishing of the substantiality of the elementary dharmas brings language into the inescapable realm of samvritti. Given the considerations above, I propose a slight modified translation that may account more decisively for the inherent combination of the two truths in each and every teaching of the Buddha. The word samuppashritya could be evoked as an additional philological reason. Its primary sense is based on, more commonly denoted by the cognate upashritya, when it's prefixed by some, could suggest the idea of concert, combination, or gathering of concurrent supporting factors. Therefore, my suggested translation, even if including here additional terms for the sake of understanding the real meaning, would be: the teaching of the Buddhas on the Dharma are based on a joint concertation or concert or combination of two truths, the conventional truth and the truth based on the ultimate reality. This proposed reading is further corroborated by stanza 10 in the sequence, I mean it's two stanzas ahead, where Nagarjuna states unequivocally, "You cannot teach Paramartha Satya without resorting to Samvritti Satya. And without realization of Paramartha Satya, Nirvana is not achieved." And finally, Chandrakirti, in his Madhyamaka Avatara, gives a definitive shape to this unique and unexpected combination of the two truths. He says, it's a fantastic, remarkable, very condensed statement, Samvritti is the means, Upaya Bhuta, and Paramartha is the goal, Upaya Bhuta. We are now in a better position to appreciate Nagarjuna's reply to the opponent. He states that there is in fact a way of speaking the unspeakable, and that the words of the Buddha have precisely that character. They don't speak directly through propositional cognitive ways, but indirectly by systematically resorting to language that targets the elimination of one's errors about reality. In other words, the Buddha's teaching are a language of the unsaying.
The what?
Unsaying. I'm making here a neologism. Unsaying.
Unsaying.
I apologize for my freedom to use the English in this way. Unsaying. Mm-hmm. That's precisely what Chandrakirti means when he states, how can there be teaching, Shruti, the word used here, and instruction, Deshana, of the Dharma, that is by nature inexpressible? And he says, it is through eliminative superimposition of ideas that inexpressible can be taught and instructed. The word which is used here is samaropa. I'm translating as eliminative superimposition. So that is the operational process of the Buddha's discourse. Therefore, the structure of the Buddha's teachings is invariably a combination of linguistic conventions and an inspiration derived from his having realized the ultimate truth. In fact, as a liberated being, the Buddha's actions can only be sourced in the ultimate truth. He can only speak from that perspective, Paramartha. Whereas on the other hand, while resorting to teaching, he has necessarily to take support of conventional language. He always speaks with Samvritti. In other words, the Buddha's teachings combine in an articulate and unique manner Samvritti Satya and Paramartha Satya. Its systematic eliminative character constitute, and for that only they are defined as such, a reorientation, a resignification, a subversion, an expansion of the original meaning of Samvritti Satya, meant to suit the requirements of the meta-conceptual level of Paramartha Satya. This extraordinary instrumentalization of Samvritti Satya is marked by a double-fold dynamics. It's an instrumentalization aptly manipulated by a being in the plenitude of self-realization. Therefore, there cannot be teaching without a context of pedagogy involving dialogue. It means here teaching is dialogue. This equation makes it unavoidable that you have to have someone who founds his discourse, though using Samvritti language, in Paramartha. So it has to have a realized man. So it has to be a dialogue. And an instrumentalization which constitutes itself as suitable adjustments to the specific soteriological requirements of the aspirants to nirvana. That's, again, the meaning or one of the meanings of upaya, that adequacy. It's precisely this purportful combination of the two truths doctrine in the context of a soteriological pedagogy founded in the Buddha's teachings that constitutes properly the nature of upaya. In other words, upayas are sets of systematic argumentative teachings in which conventional language is entrusted with a unique eliminative capability. They involve a rigorous and at the same time subversive use of empirical epistemological instruments, the pramanas, particularly the pratyaksha and the anumana. Instead of substantive reifications, these, pratyaksha and anumana, are forced to expose and unveil the absence of substantiality. Here there is an important pramana which is postulated in some schools, not in all, which is very much discussed by the Buddhist logicians, from Dinaga to Dharmottara, which is anupalabdhi, which has a very, very important role in denouncing the absence of, and in this case, of substantiality, of swabhava. In what? In the conventional pramanas, in perception, in anumana. Instead, therefore, of substantive reifications, these pramanas are forced to expose and unveil the absence of substantiality, anupalabdhi of swabhava, and the interdependent and empty nature of all one's object of attachment. It means the objects of one's metaphysical fantasies in which absolute existence or absolute non-existence is erroneously superimposed. The principles behind this subversive task are superbly discussed in Kamalashila Mula Madhyamaka Loka. In fact, he is very systematic as going one by one of these pramanas and showing how they can be subvertly used exactly to denounce unsubstantiality rather than to confirm in our day-to-day life the existence of objects of desire. In the sense that permanence here is associated in the Buddhist tradition, as my understanding goes, with attachment. Attachment is a kind of psychological counterpart of an attribution of permanence. The systematic elimination of one's obsessions, prapancha upasana, prapancha upashama, as Nagarjuna puts it, constitutes therefore a rational procedure of apophatic character in strict compliance with the rules of logic, and it has two key features. So this process of elimination with words. It has an existential efficacy since it does not pierce mere theoretical constructs. I'm not concerned about refuting the other, but conceptual constructs that are constitutives of one's being in the world. So sometimes when we concentrate the idea of refutation in the context of different schools, we tend to practically limit that idea, when in fact what it matters here is not to refute other thoughts, but to refute our own misconceptions. And therefore, these are constitutives of our existence. They are not just mere theoretical constructs. Sometimes even the theoretical concepts are exactly opposed to what in fact we practice and do. And second, this other feature of this discourse of elimination, of deconstruction, which follows the rules of logic, is that it modus operandi may resort to positive or negative propositional judgments. It's a very important fact also. In fact, in mundane usage, both positive and negative propositions are positive cognitions. When I say this is not there, this does not exist, it's a positive cognition. While their extraordinary upayaka usage should necessarily involve the elimination of other cognition. And this can only be done, and this can be done by either of the two. For example, to deny the ontological, it's provocative. To deny the ontological existence of an atma, one may circumstantially postulate a non-atma. But to deny the ontological non-existence of atma, one may circumstantially postulate an atma. In neither case, neither non-atma nor atma are being ontologically affirmed, but are merely being used as an instrument of elimination. In the ultimate analysis, one should avoid both the paths, which are deemed to be the root cause of attachment and suffering. The attachment for eternalism, would be the Atma, ontological Atma, or the attachment to nihilism. It means ontological non-Atma. Accordingly, when a final truth is taught within the linguistic propositional discourse itself, the Buddha's answer is the silence. So in one of the sutras of the Samyutta Nikaya, in the Pali, Vachagota says, Venerable Gautama asks Vachagota, is there an Atma? The Buddha is silent. Venerable Gautama, is there a non-Atma? And the Buddha is silent. Now, the alternance in the Mahayana Buddhist discourse between Shunyata, which we could say that Shunyata is formally a propositional negation, and Tathagarbha, which is formally a propositional affirmation, is again a good example of samvriti concepts, prajnapti, being used for the sake of paramartha. That is, in an eliminative sense. When we come to the sutras of the Mahayana, we see an alternance between two concepts all the time. When the Buddha says, I'm using this in a pedagogical way, that's not exactly what I mean. If you take one in a positive propositional sense, or you take another in an ontological propositional negative sense. This is this pedagogy of articulating sequence of eliminative superimpositions is beautifully described in chapter 2 of Lankavatara Sutra. I mean, I would invite you to just go through this repeatedly this process of eliminative superimpositions in succession takes place, affirming this, negating this, negating this, negating this, and so on and so forth. In short, instead of ontological doctrines, the Buddha's words, as a peculiar combination of samvriti and paramartha satya, are a continuous and systematic process of unsaying, of emptying one's erroneous conceptual attachments. The plurality of linguistic events that constitutes a soteriological dialogue between master and disciple do not have validity per se, having the status of instrumental concepts to be ultimately discarded. The final purportfulness is nirvana, that is, realization of the empty nature of all phenomena as such, or as conventionality as such. In other words, the final conclusion, which in terms of the pramanic terminology, we call it pratignya, of the argument, does not occur in the form of a propositional language, but in the form of a transformed being. Different from the causal and productive character of traditional pramanas, they produce cognitions, the Buddha's teaching as an upaya are deemed to become a pramana, which is literally pramana bhuta, as put it by Dinaga and Dhammakirti. They are entirely committed to truthfulness, but on account of a soteriological efficacy, which is nothing else but the removal of mental blocks that prevent reality to shine as it really is. So there is no causal effect here, only a removal of obstacles. That's the gist of Nagarjuna's insightful gloss of the Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra, which everybody knows. There is nothing to distinguish nirvana from samsara and samsara from nirvana. Now, to conclude, the Buddha never talks about the undescribable truth of being, to use a term from Western metaphysics. But contrary to Wittgenstein's recommendation, it does not see this as a reason to be silent. There is a famous statement of Wittgenstein, of those things we cannot speak, it's better to remain silent. Obviously, the Buddha knew that, and at the same time did not stop speaking. The amount of sutras that he spoke, my goodness. Much to the contrary, means instead of being silenced, the Buddha shows us that there is cognitive and above all soteriological functionality of language much beyond the skeptical, inverted comma, suspension of judgment. Epoche from the skeptical tradition and then resumed by the phenomenological tradition. There is something else to be done with language. It means suspension of judgment is not just in a skeptical, traditional way, classical way, to withdraw, let us say. So the Buddha shows us that there is cognitive and above all soteriological functionality of language much beyond the skeptical, inverted comma, suspension of judgment. That is much beyond the suspension of its propositional functionality. Language is not merely propositional functionality. The understanding of language, or perhaps better, of conversation or dialogue, because it's what it's at stake here, as upaya, is certainly something difficult to digest for a Western modern tradition that has by and large crystallized reason as propositional analytical judgments. But there are exceptions and countercurrent philosophical episodes. So I'll just end with Gadamer, who in his well-known commentary on Paul is talking about philosophy, but what in some way revealed that nature of philosophical language and the status of philosophical language was his commentary to poetry. Paul Celan's poetry title, Who Am I and Who Are You, is the title of the essays, which were gathered of Gadamer on Paul Celan. And he gives the closest description in Western modern philosophy of what an upaya stands for, in my opinion. He says, the language of philosophy is a language that sublates itself, saying nothing and turning towards the whole at one and the same time. I think I've jumped here and I've not noticed.
No, it was very, very coherent.
Yeah, it's interesting. So if you permit me, I just continue. Oh, no. I read it. I had separated. Yes. Thank you very much. Okay.
Well, I particularly liked your, virtually, I suppose, your final point, where you say that the result of all the teaching is not a propositional set of propositions, but it's a different kind of being, a different being. And we should take that seriously. And I think there's a great deal, one could start a new lecture with that. It's magnificent, it's very fine, and it might only, not only be true of Buddhism. But if we're take it seriously, aren't we also to take seriously that Gadamer was a Nazi? I mean, it's a serious... I'm not making a jibe or joke or attacking you. I'm just saying, if we take it seriously, do we take it seriously?
Yeah, I leave this for the biographers of Gadamer. For me, I take it. And I'm not just talking about Gadamer or Heidegger, Kierkegaard, for instance. These are authors which I selectively used. I'm not a specialist on them, to translate and understand and convey, particularly for Western audiences, what is certain more, let us say, subtle dimensions of Indian philosophy. So I'm not committed to those particular authors.
If the meaning behind your question is like how can it have worked?
That could be asked for Heidegger also. The same
question. To something like Nazi ideology, like he's.
I mean, this is the. Is particularly famous in discussing Heidegger, of course, who was a really enthusiastic Nazi.
Mm. What struck me is that this kind of I love the way you put it as kind of Pramana Buddha, like it's an unusual kind of language, and it becomes Pramana itself. It's a really lovely way of putting it.
That is Dinaga's proposition.
Yeah. Mm.
In fact, there is the whole let us say perplexity about denying Shabda Pramana in the Vedic context, and again having to assume that the teachings of the Buddha Vachanam, was also a means of knowledge.
Mm.
I mean, it's a matter of terminology in my understanding.
Mm.
The Buddha Vachanam is as much as Shabda Pramana in the Vedic tradition. Mm. But they had to deny the Shabda Pramana because of a certain pedagogical orientation of the Upanishadic tradition and reinvented one that is legitimate in the Indian tradition. Mm. But they have renamed it.
Mm.
So to understand how these Pramanas function in a different way, which for the Upanishadic tradition also, the realization of Atma is not understood as caused, and Atma is not a cognition caused by the process of knowledge. Dinaga used this expression, Pramana Bhuta. It means under the circumstances of existential efficacy, words of the Buddha are Pramana.
Well, what I've noticed is this kind of what I would call deconstructive discourse, something that you find in Nagarjuna and you find in Sextus Empiricus, it tends to get appropriated by dogmatists as well, because it's very useful for eliminating rival views. And so, you know, you get Montaigne, for example, appropriating Pyrrhonist deconstructive language to establish the authority of the Catholic Church. So maybe that's a similar thing to what you're asking about there. It's a kind of selective use of this kind of language to kind of eliminate the opposition. So it can be quite dangerous, I think. Yes.
There's one sort of comment I have on the whole thing. I wonder where we stand on this. And that is that we know that Samvarti is a false Sanskritization from Sammuti, and therefore
from
Sammuti in Pali, and it does mean truth by convention. Conventionality, Sammuti being from Samman, to agree. So everybody would agree that this is a pen. And then if you go philosophically more deeply, it's another matter. But you have to start by saying this is a pen. And that's fine. This is, understand, I'm not preparing any criticism of your paper at all. But just a question of how this tends to be talked about, because it's quite clear that as the centuries went by in India, I'm not sure that it's obvious, I'm not an expert on Nagarjuna, how Nagarjuna exactly understood the word Samvarti, but it is quite clear that it says Chandrakirti and so on, centuries later, they thought it meant concealment and that it was obfuscatory truth. And this is very, very important for the way that the Vedantins borrow it, and they say that it's obfuscatory, so it isn't really truth at all. But originally, it was exactly as you put it. It is true, a necessary part of truth, the part of truth which helps you to get to the real truth, so to speak. But so every time you translate it as conventional truth, it all fits in beautifully. But then if you use the other meaning of, you see, which is the one that comes in later, then it all becomes rather puzzling. Do you think we should sort of try to, how should I sort of, all make sure that we always translate it as conventional truth?
Yeah, we have to understand the different nuances. I would not take it, let us say, as a kind of historical dynamics in terms of the meanings, of possible meanings. For instance, you mentioned Chandrakirti. In the particular comment of this particular stanza, he gives four meanings of Samvarti. And one is, the first is the one you have mentioned. But he already lists the other possibilities, including the one which is pertinent to Upaya. It means that it may be, if inspired by Paramartha, be a liberating discourse.
Yes.
So he already has this provision. And obviously it is also a form of concealment of reality, if this insufflation and spirit of Paramartha is not present. So I think he lists these possibilities. I don't think that they are excludent and not historically determined. But here, in the stanza I was concerned to comment on the 24th, here is the question being put as far as the Buddha's teaching is concerned. Mm. It means that the Buddha has to speak Samvarti. To speak is to be Samvarti. Well, so how can he be Samvarti at the same time teach Paramartha? So that is the contextual question which I'm trying to respond.
Yes, but I mean, it's not quite such a puzzling question if you realize that for the Buddha, Samvarti have no meaning. This word couldn't mean concealment, because it didn't come from that root at all. It came from some man to agree what is commonly accepted, what is convention.
Mm. Yeah.
I think the presentation of those kind of possibly false etymologies, I'm not absolutely sure, are we, but if let's say hypothetically they are false etymologies, it's also part of the same kind of discourse. So because the ordinary mind is characterized by mistaking its own conceptual projections for reality, that this false etymology addresses that until that collapses. But then once it's collapsed, then perhaps the other meanings of Samvarti.
No, I must defend my own position is to defend the importance of history. And the fact that in Vedanta, you know, in Shankara and so on, you have a two-truth doctrine, but the lower one is actually a concealing one, is surely due to what happened to that word as it moved from Middle Indo-Aryan to Sanskrit.
Yeah, I mean, people misunderstand things, possibly.
But and we're talking about very long time periods. We're talking about many, many centuries.
Yeah. All I mean to say is that within the Mahayana, it was probably presented as a skillful means itself as well. And I'm sure they, well, I'm not sure, sure but I'm not sure. Probably they
but
didn't
I,
imagine
I think
it was
then
a
there is a fundamental difference here. And that's not my position, I will tell you, but I know that it is current in the understanding of Advaita Vedanta. This distinction, even if brought from a certain influence of the Buddhism, has a much more degree of ontological difference rather than it has in Nagarjuna. For me, Satya, Samvriti Satya and Paramartha Satya in Nagarjuna has nothing to do with two levels of ontological or reality as such.
No.
But
no,
in Advaita Vedanta, it's possible to understand this. You don't have the sophistication,
exactly
let us say, of understanding the upaya, let us say.
Yeah, that's
and
exactly
therefore, it may
I mean.
Just be a kind of way of explaining why, from one perspective, you say that Brahma is creator, but Brahma is not creator. But my argument is that the Nirguna Brahma is also Samvritti from this perspective, from the linguistic perspective. And I think Shankara is also very much aware of this. But we tend to think that, no, there is Nirguna Brahma, which is the option of Shankaracharya, whereas Saguna Brahma is a minor reality.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, yes, we have two levels of reality being articulated discursively.
Mm.
And I think this Nagarjuna, when Nagarjuna says, Shunyata is also Prajnapti, is Samvriti, I mean, it's very clear about what he means to say. Here we are using a kind of contextual concept for some eliminative finality, objective. This is not an ontology of Buddhism.
No.
It's not the ontological doctrine of emptiness.
Well, if I understand you correctly, you think, as I certainly do, that Nagarjuna was not saying anything different from the Buddha. He was just finding new ways of saying it.
He was not, correct. No. I also, yes, exactly yes. My position. Exactly. I mean, when he introduces the concept of Shunyata, in my understanding, he is, in his times, reinstating the word of the Buddha. It means that, and that's what exactly tradition amounts to. It means that you have to add, you have to include, you have to renew, you have to substitute concepts to suit, let us say, the errors of the times, to put in a language of transformation, the ignorance of the time, the suffering of the times. The suffering of the times required Shunyata. But it is very much, in my understanding, absolutely faithful to the Buddha's words. In the same way that sometimes I read the Nairatmya, understood as, we can understand in two senses, I mean the critic to substantiality in general, but if when we understand it as a critic to the Atman of the Upanishads or something like that, then for me it's contextual also. Maybe in Nagarjuna's time the problem was not the Upanishads, was something else.
Yes, at the very beginning you said, you took it all from, you moved straight on to the Sarvastivada, which was quite familiar to me. But I didn't know that you actually traced it back to the Mahasanghikas.
No, I presented two separate. It means that Nagarjuna would come from a Mahasanghika tradition.
And oh, that's what you were saying.
I'm sorry, it was not clear.
I see.
Was there a doctrine of the...
On the contrary, this doctrine of two truths is somewhat traced to the Mahasanghikas in the sense of a meta-linguistic paramartha. And therefore comes the Sarvastivada with a different proposal of giving a certain, linguistic translation to paramartha.
So are there any sort of texts from the Mahasanghika tradition that you can refer to?
This is historical. Mahasanghika, I don't know if it is a historical, sometimes postulation, but there is a division, yes, I think in the Second Council, between the Staviras and the Mahasanghikas. That is what it says. But Mahasanghikas were very extremely plural. And the question was not so much doctrinal.
No.
I think it was more related to Vinaya.
Yes.
Is correct?
Yes.
But is the Two Truths doctrine in any way, are there any extant texts?
No, I don't think there are any extant texts. We've lost almost the whole of Mahasanghika literature.
Sorry.
I mean, even the Vinaya is only preserved in Chinese translation.
Mm, mm. Yeah, so
in the Chinese, for example, they don't have anything translating to Chinese, no, the Mahasanghika.
Well, I don't know, but I don't think so.
It's Mahasanghika Vinaya.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. I think it's translating to Chinese.
Yeah.
That is, yes.
Can I just say a small thing in defense of the early skeptics that you mentioned towards the end of your essay?
Yeah, so before you comment, let me just say, I'm taking here, it is not a speech on the skeptics, no? Mm-hmm. But I think I'm going to agree with you.
Yes.
But I'm just standing for what is generally spoken about
yes.
skeptics.
Oh, yeah, okay. That's
particularly from the phenomenological tradition mm-hmm. and the interpretation of suspension of judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that Peru, for example, is not that.
Lot.
Yeah, yes.
Out of love of mankind, they say.
Yes, yes. Yes, in fact, there is a very interesting book, I've forgotten now the name of the author, which compares particularly the Pyrrhian tradition. Sometimes there is, for instance, Laertius, no, the biographer, he makes a distinction between the sixth, what is the name? Sometimes in English, I don't know, the sixth Empiricus, no? What is the name of the?
Sextus Empiricus.
Sextus Empiricus. And Pyrrhon himself,
mm.
no?
Yeah.
And, but I think if you take consideration.
This, actually, and also Christopher Beckwith is bringing out a book this year.
With Mahayana.
Called the Greek Buddha, talking about it.
Okay. But there is a text which is a book and is an article first, then it was transformed as a book, comparing the Mahayana tradition and the skeptical tradition.
Yeah, Thomas McCavely's
book. Yes, yes,
and Adrian Kosminski's book as well. Buddhism, how the Greeks reinvented Buddhism.
Yeah, and I think one very interesting thing about, for me, that the perplexity sometimes of Indian philosophy, since I was a foothold also in Western philosophy, is that force us to look back at Western philosophy
mm.
and do not take anything for granted about the Hegelian narrative. Mm. Yes? We have to
start retranslating.
We have to rescue things that perhaps we never thought that were there in Plato and Aristotle and so on.
Mentioned the emptiness is blajnapti.
I'm sorry?
The emptiness is blajnapti. And in which text do you find this?
In the Mula Madhyamakakarika. When he wants to say to the opponent, see my friend, emptiness is also prajnapti.
So
you are understanding in the wrong way what it means.
Yeah.
Emptiness.
It's in the gentler qualities. Commentary is cited the Nagarjuna's.
No, it's Nagarjuna's. Yes, I can mail you to the exact verse of it.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have some? Have you found some expression like emptiness is empty?
Yeah, something. Like, I think the idea is this.
Yeah, but no exact sentence.
I think when he speaks
mm-hmm.
of emptiness as prajnapti, he's saying this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. We don't have to have this kind of more, let us say, impactant wording,
mm-hmm.
like I myself may.
Because in Chinese translation, this is very famous. This expression, emptiness, is also empty. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if there's...
I think you will find lots of this in the Tibetan tradition, for
Tibetan
sure, in Tsongkhapa and so on.
It's in Chandrakirti
as
well.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chandrakirti is the great mentor, in fact, of the Tibetan tradition, perhaps even as much as Nagarjuna, or more than Nagarjuna.
Nagarjuna does say emptiness is not something which is supposed to be an object of discussion. It's only expressed as a kind of narrative to guide people. So he makes a clear kind of exception about the use of this discourse.
You come from a Buddhist tradition? Which?
Nyingma, Tibetan.
Okay. How is your reading of Nagarjuna?
It's wonderful to hear you speak, because I think it's really lovely to hear someone who's, I think, really passionate about it, and that it's a taste that you can get if you're getting into Nagarjuna. I don't know, I'd like to hear it. Although we have a lot of refutations of Tsongkhapa's presentation, but
Tsongkhapa, I just take it, let us say, as a kind of, because of general Tibetan tradition, which I think it's very rational in that sense, therefore more close to what I can speak about Buddhism, which is the Indian Buddhism. Outside India, I'm at loss. And I don't know Tibetan, so I'm a little blind to
a
more in-depth look of Tsongkhapa's
text. If you look at Mipham's Beacon of Certainty, it's a wonderful Nyingma send-up of Gelugpa presentation of Nogarjuna. It's quite funny.
Okay, so...
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.